I was leaving Los Angeles by train and pulling out of Union Station. And I saw the LA River. And when I first heard about your effort, this is complete honesty, so forgive me for the, forgive me for this. When I first heard about you trying to restore the LA River, which is basically a concrete, it's basically like an alley. Like I grew up in Chicago with these concrete alleys with this little groove in the middle where the water could go. I thought, this to totally restore this, he's a crazy man. It's not going to happen. He's a lunatic. He's crazy. When I was leaving LA by train from Union Station, I saw that river, and I knew of your dream of restoring it to something approximating its natural state. And I realized at the moment it was not the scheme of a madman, but a necessary and virtuous task. Why don't you tell us about how you first got the notion that you were going to spend a considerable amount of your life energy fostering the idea that you should restore the that society, that the United States government, the California state government, L.A. city government should restore the L.A. River?
Well, I had lived all through the 1970s in Bolinas, California, which is a very beautiful town on the Pacific coast about 40 miles north of San Francisco. And I had been a political person all my life. I grew up, my parents were the only liberals in this North Dallas suburb, and some of my earliest memories are going to these precinct conventions in our neighborhood in which the votes on issues would be 187-2. And my mom and dad would be the only ones who would be voting in favor of bigger government or more liberal anti-segregation policy. So I come from, although my parents would never have thought of themselves as radical in any sense and weren't in politically, but I grew up in what I thought of as a radical tradition. And I was I was a member of SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, which was a left-wing organization that became a strong opponent of the Vietnam War. And SDS basically imploded in 1968 in Chicago, afterwards I didn't know what to do. I was very opposed to the Vietnam War. I had turned in my draft card. I would only communicate with my draft board in rhymed couplets. And
seriously?
Yeah.
Did you remember any of them?
No, I can't remember any of them anymore.
Did you print those?
No. That would just, you know, it was those things. They would send me forms, and I would just send back these, you know, rhyme couplets. I wish I did have them. You know, at those times, I wasn't that felt like my work didn't quite matter on that level to anybody else but me and the draft board. But anyway, so ultimately, I was called up for a draft physical, and I was. When I told them about certain dreams, they said, well, you may call them visions, we call them paranoid ideations. And I was eventually, you know, not considered worthy of going to Vietnam. But I was really at a loss to how to stop the war, and I could tell going underground wasn't the answer. And so I moved to the country, and I moved to this town called Bolinas. And, it was like tune in, turn on, drop out. Here I am in this beautiful place, two sides Pacific Ocean, two sides National Park, and it's like paradise, and with dirt roads. And about a week after I arrived there, two oil tankers collided under the Golden Gate Bridge, and suddenly our entire town is fighting to keep this bunker oil, which is like tar, out of the Bolinas Lagoon, one of the last lagoons on the coast of California. And for several days, we built the whole town together. A couple of thousand hippies built a log boom across this channel to keep in and stood on this boom. And as the current moved in and out, you know, dropping straw in front of this boom to pick up the tar, and then with pitchforks moving these globs of tar. I mean, it's this heroic act, and you know, out over onto the beach. And it was an incredibly inspiring moment in my life, and a moment that was very revelatory because, A, I realized what I was hardly the first person to realize is that all politics is local, and that, two, water politics is the root of all politics. If you don't have water, you don't have politics. And so I became very interested in water politics. I was elected to the Bolinas Public Utility District, helped design and oversee the construction of the first or second, I guess actually the second, sewage recycling system in California, and became very involved in water issues because our town wasn't incorporated, so we essentially governed. The hippies took over the public utility district and essentially governed the town through the public utility district. when I moved to L.A. for completely different reasons, I had never been to L.A., even though I lived 400 miles from it. And, you know, actually, I'd been there once when my best friend from Dallas, who was this hellraiser, decided to marry his girlfriend in L.A., but he got drunk and beat her up the night before the wedding, and he spent his wedding day in jail. So that was my only experience of Los Angeles. And when I got to L.A., I was just totally broke, and I got what they used to call in those a CETA job, which was you'd get $4 an hour minimum wage to do all this. It was a Jimmy Carter era federal work project. And I was so poor. I had a car, but I couldn't afford gas. And so I was taking the bus from Venice, which is out on the Pacific, all the way downtown to where I was working on this job. And I saw the L.A. River one day walking to the bus stop. And when I saw the L.A. River, it was this strange thing. I mean, it was at dusk in the winter, and it was just, you know, you could see this incredible amount of concrete. I'd never seen anything like it. I didn't know anything about it. And yet, somehow, I knew that my life and this river were going to be entwined. I mean, it was obvious that it couldn't get more screwed up. They're obviously in yin and yang that it was going to get better. And I took the experiences that I had in politics and water politics in Bolinas, and basically just I realized I could apply them into this vast machine of humanity called Los Angeles, this huge cementscape. And everybody thought I was joking, you know, and I saw it. It was a performance piece, too. It was very much about. At that time, I was doing a lot of performances. I had been in the late 70s. I'd gotten sick of giving poetry readings, so I started just standing up and making up poems. I worked in the early evening at a punk club called the Mabuhe Gardens, which was the main punk club of San Francisco, and they couldn't plug in until 10 o'clock, so they would do all kinds of weird stuff earlier. And I ran a bunch of poetry events. It was the beginning of the Jim Carroll Band. It was Bill Talon, who started A Life on the Water, a theater, was one of the, this was his some of his first performances. He's now the Reverend Billy of the Church of Stop Shopping in New York, and they do shopping interventions in the Disney store in Times Square and stuff like that. And he's become like this reverend, you know, he's become one of his characters. And anyway, so when I got to L.A., people said that was performance art. So I decided to create a performance art that was of tremendous duration, because that was a period where I was starting to learn about performance art, where artists like Chris Burden were doing works where he'd be locked himself into a locker for 3 days, or another work that he did in San Francisco where he sat on a pedestal in an art gallery for days and days till he just fell off from exhaustion. There was a guy named Sam Shea who lived outside in Manhattan, never came indoors once for a year. And a woman who's an artist, Linda Montano, had herself, she with a rope tied to the wrist into a guy's wrist for a year.
So in this context, talking about restoring the L.A. River might have seemed, you know, normal, I guess.
Oh, yeah, exactly. You know, and so I said, I want to do it, because I'm a very competitive person. I said, well, these people are just a year. That's nothing for a performance piece. I want to do a 40-year work. And so I set up Friends of the Los Angeles River in my mind and announced it as a 40-year artwork to restore the river. And, you know, and I realized, A, it was probably going to take that long at least, but also just to sort of, you know, I figured, well, I probably wasn't going to live 40 years, so I wanted to make a work that would teach me patience, because I always have trouble with patience. And it would also, you know, like outlast me, so I could do a work that I wouldn't even have to be alive to keep doing. So
the website is very good, folar.org, yeah. Friends of L.A. River, folar.org. We only got a couple of minutes left.
Oh,
you know what I'm thinking? Maybe reading from
would be
the right thing to do. So
yeah.
Talking with Lewis McAdams, the effort to restore the Los Angeles River to something approximating its original state. And you're going to read from the book. Tell us about
this
the book.
This book is called The River, Books 1 and 2. It's for many years when I was doing the river effort, starting the river effort, I wrote zillions of op-ed pieces and letters to the editors and, you know, all kinds of propagandistic writing, but I couldn't write poems. And finally, rereading Patterson, William Carlos Williams' great poem that is about the Passaic River, another pathetic and ill-used by human river in New Jersey. He said, there's a quote right at the beginning of Patterson, which obviously helped him, which is, to make a start out of particulars and make them general, rolling up the sum by defective means. And so that inspired me. I mean, I thought, well, I've got the defective means, and I can put all these little works together. And so I started working this. So this is the first two books. It was published a couple years ago by something called Blue Press in San Francisco. I'm working on a third book now, and I hope to have several more books before it's done. This is a poem that's actually been reproduced. Now it's on a, it's gonna, it, they're building the blue line from downtown to Pasadena, a light rail line, and in one of the stations, this poem is gonna be incorporated into the station, actually, and it's been printed a bunch of times. It's to Artesia, and Artesia is a kind of pagan goddess of the spring. I mean, an artesian well in its purest form is you can just, you know, put a stick in the ground and water will burst from the ground. And so Artesia is a kind of goddess of the spring. I think its origins are somewhere, or possibly a Mediterranean. I think of the river the way it reads in the Sam Shepard story, Cruise in Paradise, a huge concrete serpent, a dumping ground for murder victims. I think of the river beside a freeway off-ramp as rollerbladers bent into it, spandexed buttocks rotating, roll downstream. I think of William Mulholland's gentle, limpid stream coursing from a pharaoh's forehead or from the brow of a Rhine maiden, green-eyed and coffee-colored, a bracelet of drowned children wrapped around her wrist, descending from the mountains east of Irwindale into the Jardin des Rocas. The river is a rigorous mistress, but when you tickle her with your deeds, you can hear laughter from beneath her concrete corset.
Wow, that really says it very well. It's great to hear you read that, and what a great resonant voice. There once was a plan created by the Olmsted brothers, landscape architecture firm that was responsible for Central Park and other great projects, to handle flood control. And basically, briefly, a version of that vision is what you have in mind.
Very much so, although in fact when we started we had no idea what we were doing with the Olmsted Brothers plan has just been republished with a very interesting introduction by Bill Deverell, a historian at Caltech. It's called Eden Revisited, is what they call this reissue. And it's basically, it was a plan to take all the water courses of Los Angeles Basin and reserve them for parkland and for runoff, and as a way to control flooding, and as a way to create a great system of parks. As soon as they finished it, it was utterly ignored forever. I mean, it came right at the beginning of the freeway building era, and no one wanted to hear from it. And in fact, what we're trying to do now is essentially retrofitting the Los Angeles Basin, an immense project which will cost billions of dollars and will take generations. But you know, it's
going to happen, isn't it?
Yeah, it's happening. You know, we've created in the last 5 years about a dozen parks along the river. We just won a lawsuit to create another 30-acre park in downtown Los Angeles. There's so much interest in the river now, and it's actually, I'm not shocked, weirdly enough, although many people are, it was one of those rare moments in my life where I actually saw what would happen. I mean, it's probably the only moment in my life where I ever saw what was happening. And it's played out. I didn't know it would be quite as hard as I was. I mean, as it was. But it's playing out in a way now. The river, the Los Angeles River has become a kind of repository for idealism. I mean, so I see so much of people's desire to improve their place.
It's nice when common sense catches up, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's even more than common sense. It's more about people wanting to make the place they live better. You know, it's something that people had always sort of ignored about L.A. as it just got worse and worse. But
I think we all want that.
Yeah.
I wish you continued success with your work on the river.
Well, thanks a lot. This is a great chance to talk about
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Lewis McAdams, we're talking about the Los Angeles River, the effort to restore that to something approximating its original state, folar.org. We'll have a link on our website at nperia.org. And also the book, Birth of the Cool, Beat bebop, and the American avant-garde.